And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. Those who stayed up late Sunday night had the opportunity to see the Golden Globes for themselves, but those who didn't will be glad to know we're going to take a quick look at the good, the bad, and that thing that happened with Jodie Foster. Because you can't get too much of awards season, we'll be skipping from that to the recent Oscar nominations, or more precisely, the recent non-Oscar nominations. We'll talk about whether being snubbed is really even a thing, and then we'll highlight some of what we loved last year that didn't make the cut. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, Trey Graham is under the weather this week, has been battling the flu like half of the rest of the civilized world. Fortunately, we have with us Bob Mondello. Bob,
yay! I've been following Trey everywhere.
Bob Mondello, what do you do at NPR?
I review movies and the arts for All Things Considered.
Those of you who listen to the podcast will remember Bob from, among other things, our show from the Toronto Film Festival.
Yep, which
and
is
we
great
are
time.
We are back full circle as year-end movie stuff is happening. But before that, the Golden Globes. Now, I was on duty last night.
Yes.
We're taping this on Monday. Last night was Sunday. I was on duty live blogging the Golden Globes. So people have heard many of my thoughts about the Golden Globes. Stephen, did you watch the Golden Globes?
You know, I actually did. I didn't read your live blog, though.
No, of course not.
No,
what did
I was
think?
Off the clock. Yeah. I found it to be sort of a shockingly enjoyable awards show.
I thought that, too.
I think that the kind of lightness of the Golden Globes, the way the stars are sort of arrayed around tables with drinks, lends itself to kind of a lighter, bawdier, sillier show. And I think they've
often... It does not take itself so seriously.
They've often... In order to match those surroundings, they've often had as hosts people like Ricky Gervais, who's there to kind of puncture the Hollywood fakery with his zingers. And instead of that, they went with people who are loose and friendly and funny
and
playful. They were Tina Fey and Amy Poehler.
Right. Who have wonderful chemistry, partly because they are best friends and they've been best friends forever.
And it really, it shows in the shtick.
Yeah.
And I just found them, even when a bit was silly, they would throw in fake nominees where they would be sitting out in some of those I thought were very, very funny.
Yeah, why has it taken this long, after almost 100 years of these shows, why has it taken this long for somebody to do the fake nominee gag? Because that really was fun.
Yeah.
President was fun.
I also really, really, really enjoyed when they themselves were nominated to have Tina Fey nervous with J-Lo and Amy Poehler flirting with George Clooney. It was just a very... I just found them incredibly agreeable. That and the fact that there were so many awards given out.
Yes.
I felt like the telecast did not lag.
It is an awards show made up largely of giving out awards.
Unlike the Grammys, which last year gave out 9 in 3 hours.
Stephen and I have been known to live blog the Grammys, and that is an award show with very few awards. This is more like boom, 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 boom. You get your award, you're off the stage, they play you off. They don't care if you are Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yeah.
Play off the stage.
Scram, Daniel Day-Lewis. We're just going to have to listen to you yap at the end of February anyway.
I actually didn't watch very much of the awards. I watched a little bit of it. I did read your live blogging, though, which was a good deal more fun, and it allowed me to watch Big Bang Theory at the same time. So.
Excellent.
No, but I there were moments in it that I thought were kind of amazing. I was there for the opening monologues or dialogues,
yeah.
I guess, which were enormous fun. I could watch Tina Fey forever. And I also liked the fact that she could not just instantly do Sarah Palin's voice, which hadn't occurred to me that you have to get into it somehow.
Yeah.
She just seemed such a natural at it.
Yeah.
You know, I miss the old days of the Golden Globes. The Globes are supposed to be tacky. They're supposed to be gauche. I hark back to the days of
Pia Zadora
winning.
Yeah.
But, you know, a word that I've never put to this show is classy, and last night's show was actually classy.
Yeah, it's true. I do get the sense that they've read the press indicating that people find the Golden Globes rather drunk. And I do get the sense that they maybe try to keep people from being quite as drunk.
Watering Quentin Tarantino's drinks.
I have to say, my favorite part of the opening monologue, in addition to the joke about being married to James Cameron being a point of credibility on torture, which I thought instantly was a much more daring joke than anything Ricky Gervais did while he was hosting those awards. But my other favorite one, and I was talking to Stephen about this, I can't remember if it was at the very, very beginning or a little bit later, when they did the back and forth about Tina Fey was like, the Hunger Games is what I did to get into this dress. And then Amy Poehler said, the life of Pi is what I'm going to do after this dress. And then they like high-fived. There's something about that sort of, they have that quality to their back and forth that I enjoyed a whole lot. I will say, mostly boring clothes, except for Lucy Liu. I know nobody cares about that except me. This is where we miss Trey. But and I would say this, too. When Bob and I saw Marion Cotillard in Rust and Bone, Bob had said when she makes the awards rounds, she should wear dresses that are short so you can see she really has legs. And she totally did.
I was so proud of having predicted that when I saw her.
She was one of the few women who had a dress that had a short enough part of it that her legs were fully showing. And I was like, she wants you to know she really has legs, because in this movie she has
lost them.
It was amazing. So, you know, in terms of the actual awards, Homeland was the big drama winner. Girls was the big comedy winner, which was maybe a little bit of a surprise, but not hugely.
Well, it was sort of nice to see something other than Modern Family win those
that
awards.
That is true. And Argo was the, to me, slight surprise pick for dramatic film. Yeah.
I think Lincoln has felt like a shoe-in for all these awards for so long that it's really weird to think that Argo could conceivably do it. Yeah.
It's so surprising that the better movie won.
I think Lincoln...
I'm not sure I agree with that.
Well, Lincoln is going to win the Oscar because, like the Oscars, Lincoln is a big, bloated piece of phony baloney bombast.
Oh, man.
And I like it better than that.
And it lines up with what the Oscars are very
nice. This is Bob's experience talking to us about Midnight in Paris all over again.
I think it's fair to say that the Foreign Press Association might not be as attuned to Lincoln as it is to some of the other pictures.
It did occur to me at one point.
True. But Joe Reed, who was one of the people live blogging with me, did point out that the Globes have particularly recently, a very poor history of agreeing with the Oscars about Best Picture.
Well, and they take two shots at it, too.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's true. Their last three picks for Best Drama were The Descendants, The Social Network, and Avatar.
Wow.
So they have not been hitting the Oscar jackpot. And if you go back before that, they got Slumdog Millionaire, but before that, there's a bunch of other ones. Right. They picked Babel and Atonement and a bunch of other things that did not go on to win the Oscar.
Well, and as one of you just said, they do split those categories. They split Best Picture into Best Drama and Best, I love this, Comedy or Musical. Yeah. Because the winner, Les Miserables, is nothing if not a laugh riot. Da-da-da-da-da-da. Hey!
Yeah, that's on the light side. Yeah. Les Miserables was the entry from the light side.
I mean, musical or comedy? How many musicals in a given
year? Well, it used
to
make more sense.
It's fairly safe if it's musical comedy. But I mean, with Hairspray, it made sense. It just doesn't make sense with this one.
It's true. So I think the biggest news probably coming out of the entire Golden Globes had nothing to do with any of the awards. It was this speech that Jodie Foster gave. So let's listen to a little bit of that.
So while I'm here being all confessional, and I guess I just have a sudden urge to say something that I've never really been able to air in public. So declaration that I'm a little nervous about, but maybe not quite as nervous as my publicist right now. Huh, Jennifer? You know, I'm just going to put it out there, right? Loud and proud, right? So I'm going to need your support on this. I am single. Yes, I am. I am single. No, I'm kidding. But I mean, I'm not really kidding, but I'm kind of kidding. I mean, thank you for the enthusiasm. Can I get a wolf whistle or something? Please. Jesus. Seriously. I hope that you're not disappointed that there won't be a big coming out speech tonight, because I already did my coming out about 1,000 years ago, back in the Stone Age.
I was certainly confident she was not about to say, I'm gay. So she said, I'm single. But then she went on to talk about being separated from apparently her long-term partner. And although I read today they were already apart for a while, and I'm not sure I really understand all that or care about it that much.
Yeah.
But she went on to talk about her sense that she wanted privacy, and she talked about the pressure she has felt like she was under to talk about being gay. And it was, to me, a very odd speech, I have to admit.
I think that's fair. Odd and apparently off the cuff. You know, I do a lot of speaking in front of groups, but I usually have a script when I'm doing it. And she pretty clearly did not. And it was a striking piece of conversation, kind of. But it really did wander. it was weird to watch because initially you thought she's having a sort of a breakdown here.
Yeah.
And then you thought, no, she's in control of what right. she's doing. She's just doing something strange.
Right.
And it was just, it was a very weird thing to watch, but kind of makes her interesting again for somebody who, you know, I don't think 50 is so old.
No. No.
And good for her that she got there. But, you know, I thought it made her, I can't wait to see what she does next.
Well, and I think that's part of what's striking about it is when I think of Jodie Foster, I sort of think of complete control. Mm-hmm. Like, she's a natural for an actor who would go on to direct mm-hmm. because she has this very, she's very put together. Mm-hmm. She's very clean looking.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of
except in now.
Right, except in now. But I mean, she has a perfectionist.
I know what you mean.
A perfectionist way about her.
It's a restrained energy. It's a controlled energy.
And so to have her seem to wander off script, you know, like, this is my opportunity to say things I don't usually say, mm-hmm. but also hold back things I want to hold back.
Yeah.
It really did kind of ebb and flow in a way that made it really hypnotic to watch.
Yeah. Part of the speech that isn't getting a lot of attention today that I think should is the really moving way she talked about dealing with her mother.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Man, that just floored me. That was sincere and well said and generous and great. Now, the reaction that I'm seeing today to the speech kind of falls into three categories. You have, well, four if you count good for her.
Right.
That's one category.
Yeah.
She's a role model. She owes it to the nation's gay youth to come out and not to hide. That's one response.
Mm-hmm.
Two, if she doesn't want us to care, then why bring it up at all?
Mm-hmm.
And three, and this is the one I found most puzzling, was a sense of how dare she?
Yes.
The Gawker piece,
yes.
which has been getting a lot of
yes.
Attention today, basically came out and said,
how dare she what?
How dare she stand on a stage with all this attention on her and say, don't pay attention to me? How dare she be an actress?
How dare she receive the award she was given
well,
by others?
If yes. you get all the way through the Gawker piece, the guy makes a distinction which I thought was brutally honest, concise, but repellent, which is, either you're an actress, a celebrity, and we get to learn everything about you,
yeah, no.
or you're not, and we don't care. I mean, I thought that was really stark,
mm-hmm.
and I admired the fact that he came out and said it, because that seems to be the motivating principle
of Gawker,
yeah. for example.
But people say that a lot about, like, this is the way it is, and they kind of distance themselves
yeah.
from that mentality.
Right.
I haven't actually read the Gawker piece. It sounds like I needn't.
Yeah, well, it was interesting, because Sam Adams from the AV Club described the Gawker piece. He sort of said, summed it up as, if you make a movie, I have the right to look up your dress.
Right.
Which,
which
I kind of, I mean,
I
think that's an exactly correct view of what the piece was essentially saying. And I just don't agree with it. I do think that if you are out there, you know, if you're someone who gives lots of interviews about your personal life when
right.
it benefits you, and
right.
you like to do that when mm-hmm. it's good for you, and then you want to turn around and say, oh no, now I want my privacy, I understand being aggravated by that. But Jodie Foster has always been a very private person, relatively speaking, not exclusively about this.
Right.
I mean, there are so many things for me to opine about. I don't really think that people need me to have an opinion about whether she has an obligation to come out or not.
Right.
But I do think she's always been a person who did not want a lot of attention to her personal life.
Well, and
obviously
it's hardly
and
hardly tries to draw attention to herself in order
right.
to promote things.
And obviously she has the history of
sure.
the stuff surrounding John Hinckley and the
yeah.
Reagan assassination attempt, and has said, I think, I mean, I don't know. From someone who was involved in that, it makes so much more sense to me even than it would with a normal person.
If there's one person I cut millions of square yards of slack, it would be a person who... This isn't about, like, the paparazzi bother her during brunch at Spago.
Right.
This is about a man tried to kill a president to impress her when she was a teenager. That is an exceptional experience, and it had nothing to do with her. I can see
and
how that would...
it's a form of stalking. I mean, it was stalking.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it had nothing to do with what she was doing. It is this
right.
thing that in the public perception will now always be a part of her, even though she had nothing to do
yeah.
with
she
it.
She did not ask for that.
So I can see how somebody would be extra sensitive to
mm-hmm.
the issues of privacy. Now, mm-hmm. there is a discussion going on today on the web about privacy versus secrecy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good discussion to have. But again, I just cut her all kinds of slack.
Wouldn't you cut any celebrity slack? I mean, with a few notable exceptions, people
mm-hmm.
who go out of their way to be central to, I don't know, the Examiner or whatever,
right.
whatever
yeah.
it is. But it seems to me that the fact of being a star in the sense that we make people stars, and that's a manufactured thing to begin with,
right.
that being that shouldn't suggest any kind of obligation to talk to people about anything personal.
Right.
I mean, the thing about Hollywood is that the stars who make it onto the cover of the tabloids tend to be people who are going out of their way to get
right.
there one
right.
way or the other.
Right.
And there are lots of people who drive 10-year-old cars mm-hmm. and still make a whole bunch of money mm-hmm. in Hollywood, but do not feel that nobody feels they should be jumping all around and looking at right. pictures of.
Yeah, I did take exception to one part of her speech, which wasn't even a thing, where she kind of slagged reality television and saying that everybody right. nowadays feels they need to do a reality show, and she threw poor Honey Boo Boo under the bus.
She did. A child star.
I know. It's weird. But here's the thing. She grew up at a different time, and her view of what the coming out process is no longer true, this idea that you have to, you know, have a press conference. I mean, if anything, coming out has become a very matter-of-fact thing.
Yeah,
Anderson Cooper did it in an email.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just last week, the actor Matt Dallas, who he might not have been out, but his name sure was. Matt Dallas. Gayest name ever. He just basically Twittered a picture of his fiance, and that's it. Boom, done. I mean,
right.
so it is becoming, more matter of fact, I'm very grateful and very happy that it is, but I just don't think she has this sense of
gay
community. She's 50, don't forget.
There yeah. is that.
Well, first of all, oh my God, she's ancient. She's 50. Bob, how can you even...
No. She looks great. Just felt I needed to throw that in.
But think about what her very, very sort of slow public coming out processes included, which are things like was it The Advocate or was it Out that put the picture of like her and Anderson Cooper, like masks.
Yeah,
I don't remember. She's sort of dealt with, and she certainly could have made it go away, I suppose, by simply coming out or putting out an email or
right.
whatever. But she's probably felt more pressure by the way it has sort of dragged out for all these years. I mean, the fact that there's all this anticipation, like, will she or won't she? Like, my God.
Yeah.
You know, first of all, we already know.
Well, and she has acknowledged her partner before. So I think part of where people wound up was, if you will do that, then why won't you just say you're gay? Like,
right.
what is the deal? And that's where this privacy versus secrecy thing comes in for me, where it's like, I get it. I get not wanting to talk about your personal life. I get not wanting to have everybody looking through your trash. I get all that. But I'm also sympathetic to people who I've heard make the argument that, you know, it's fine for you to know that this is my partner and, you know, and I live with her and we raise kids together, but somehow I'm not going to say it.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
then it becomes, like, why? And it leads to a certain...
It leads to a sense on
some people's parts that you are either embarrassed by it or
right.
you...
Then it's
or
a
you,
deep, dark secret in some
but,
way.
But I think with somebody like her, like, she is so independent. She is so singularly driven, and I think she has had to be so independent that I almost feel like there comes a point where she feels pressured so much that now she's like, now I'm not doing it. Like, she feels like to give that speech that people want to hear is caving to pressure.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then she becomes even more, I don't want to do it. I'm not going to talk about
that's
it.
That's why you do it in a tweet, man.
I'm not your puppet.
That's why you email it.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it's really interesting what Glenn said, because I hadn't thought about it that way. But it's absolutely true that it's become this very matter-of-fact thing where, I mean, certain people like Zachary Quinto, like, I
right.
think the only thing that happened with Zachary Quinto is, like, he talked about it, and then there were pictures of him and his boyfriend walking their dogs. I
yep.
remember that. But I don't really remember much else yeah. anybody caring other
well,
than that.
It's that society has changed so much in the last few years. It seems weird to me that there's a whole generation of people for whom coming out at 13 is not a big deal.
Right.
Because
yeah.
at 13, it would have been horrifying
yeah.
for me.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, hell, at 25, it was fairly horrifying yeah. for me. And so it was, you know, I can't even imagine that there are people who come out to their middle schools and just deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And yet there's two generations out there now that have done that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, well, this isn't really the Globes anymore.
It's the Globes.
It's
We're talking
the Globes.
About the speech.
All
it's
right.
the biggest piece of news that came out
well,
of
it. Well, wait. There was also President Clinton.
Yeah.
Yes, there was.
Right.
And granted, he was scripted, but his
appearance... He didn't filibuster for 48 minutes.
but the fact that he got up there and got a chance to talk about Lincoln in a way that was clearly politically motivated and was aimed at the, how many people have seen Lincoln? That's $150 million, so that's
mm-hmm.
almost 20 million people
mm-hmm.
in this country have seen Lincoln.
You have not paid to go to a movie in Washington, D.C. lately, have you? Either that or you haven't taken math class.
A lot of people go to the matinees. but anyway, an awful lot of people have seen
mm-hmm.
that movie and understood what he was saying specifically about a recalcitrant Congress and all of that. And I thought that was really kind of neat. Spielberg presumably invited him to do this,
mm-hmm.
but that he came on was a politically motivated thing right now, and really smart, it seems
to me. I like that Bill Clinton answers to Spielberg. It's sort of how it works, isn't it?
Everybody answers to Spielberg. Well, if you watched the Golden Globes or you want to tell us what you thought, please come to our Facebook page at facebook.com/PCHH or to the blog at npr.org/PCHH. Lest you think that that's all that there is to awards season, last week out came the Oscar nominations. I don't know about the rest of you. I was up watching them early in the morning.
Well, for us, early in the morning is like 8:30.
Well, that's true.
If we were in L.A., would we? You would have gotten up.
I would have gotten up. I would have had to get up. But others, maybe not so much. So there were 9 Best Picture nominees this year. We had Amour, Argo, Beasts of the Southern Wild, Django Unchained, Les Miserables, Life of Pi, Lincoln, Silver Linings Playbook, and Zero Dark Thirty. So out of a possible 10, we got 9.
Now, in a future episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour, we will sort of go movie by movie through the Best Picture nominees. So this is not that segment.
This is not our primary actual Oscar segment. We thought we would talk about what wasn't nominated. Now, when you talk about what isn't nominated, you run into this issue of the so-called snub.
Yeah. Got really tired of that word very quickly.
Yeah. Well, I have 2 problems with the word snub. One is it implies you have to believe that the existing nominations are sort of wrong in some way to believe that somebody was snubbed.
Or you don't. You just complain about who didn't get in without saying who should have been left out, which drives me bananas.
Yeah. And my other issue is people don't vote that way.
Right, right.
But wait. With this, you can have up to 10.
That's true.
So leaving something out means that it was left out by design.
There is that one category, because of this sort of screwball way that they do Best Picture, where you can wind up sort of the equivalent of in the Baseball Hall of Fame, where they nominated nobody or they named nobody to the Hall of Fame.
Right.
And that counts as a snub. But I think the way you have 9 Best Picture nominees instead of 10, it's very natural to say that whatever your favorite movie of the year that was not those 9 got snubbed.
Well, that's true. They did snub the Avengers.
They did. I loved the Avengers.
They snubbed the Avengers. But, you often hear the word snub in connection with something like Kathryn Bigelow not being nominated for Best Director. And although I would agree that that was unexpected, and it's partly unexpected because of her awards history and everything. But while it was unexpected, I don't know who I would un-nominate.
Well, I mean,
from the people who were picked.
Best Director is definitely the one that has the most surprises. The nominees for Best Director are Steven Spielberg, Ang Lee, Michael Haneke,
Ben Zeitlin.
Ben Zeitlin. Beasts of the Southern Wildington. David O. Russell. Ben Affleck did not get nominated.
Oh, you're right.
I find several of those nominations pretty deeply puzzling, just from a degree of difficulty
Several of them.
From a degree of difficulty standpoint. I look at Best Director, and I know
Steven's like, I could make Lincoln.
I think we get into the I am not a crackpot. But there's an element to some movies that have the element of if you execute them perfectly, it's like an Olympic high dive where you go swish and do nothing. But it's perfectly straight. It makes very little splash. But then you have movies that involve your Quentin Tarantinos, for example, that involve a certain amount of somersaulting and curly-cueing.
So you want it to be an award for the most directing.
There is a little bit of a sense. You take a movie like Amour, terrific movie. It's virtually all set in one apartment. It's very contained. He makes a lot of decisions that you think about that are not necessarily obvious. It's sort of like being a really great mayor of a small town as opposed to being a really great president of the United States in terms of making a movie like Argo that did not get nominated for Best Director, even though Ben Affleck won the Golden Globe.
That's what was confusing me. Yeah.
A movie like Argo involves all this managing of kind of a small city with hundreds and hundreds of moving parts. Was the job of directing Argo a more difficult job and a greater accomplishment than, for example, what David O. Russell did in Silver Linings Playbook, which is a very
But Stephen, you can't. It's, you're talking about logistics, and yeah, but this is reaching. Well,
part
this
of
is
it is I'm terrible at logistics, so I admire them so much.
By that measure, Avengers should have been best.
No, no, no. Cloud Atlas should have been
absolutely
because it is. It has six plots, and it is the most incoherent thing in the planet.
Well, right,
but they had to get a lot in there.
Right.
I mean, no, but if Cloud Atlas had woven those plots together seamlessly and been easy to follow and good, then that would have been an amazing directorial accomplishment compared to a smaller movie.
Yeah, I just don't think
not so much.
I'm more making the argument than agreeing with the argument. I'm just saying it's part of why it seems so unlikely that those directors were chosen over directors who juggled hundreds of millions of dollars worth of distractions.
Well, the thing is, what makes your case to a certain extent is that the Directors Guild really liked Argo and really liked Zero Dark Thirty. And they, in theory at least, the Directors Guild being made up entirely of directors, are the people who know what is good directing.
Well, and directors who are like,
wait a minute, I thought on the Oscars directors nominated directors and screenwriters nominated screenwriters.
Oh, I won't pretend I know what
I
the nominating policy is.
I can't remember that either.
These days, it's more complicated than that, and they did an electronic ballot, and I don't, forgive me, I just don't know the answer.
So what you're saying is that Harvey Weinstein hacked the ballot, which is why Silver Linings Playbook was nominated for absolutely everything.
I think that's absolutely clear. No, the answer is, to some extent, and this is only to some extent, that Lincoln gives you a very carefully controlled Spielbergian look at an event that took place about 150 years ago. And it is a very different animal than, say, Amour. And it is not trying to make you believe that you're there in the room with someone who's dying, for instance.
Right.
It is trying to make an exquisite-looking Hollywood motion picture. Amour puts you in a room with a woman who's dying, and you believe, while you're there, that you're experiencing it for real, that you're looking at something that is almost documentary reality. Those are two very different skills. Spielberg could certainly make Amour, but it would be a really different picture.
Oh, he would have ruined it with the music. Is what he would have. We'll talk about Amour on another on another episode, but his non-use of music is, boy, we'll talk about that in a later episode.
Yeah, so let me ask you, Bob. What did you love this year that was not nominated? Did you have any heartbreakers?
Yeah, John Hawkes. I mean, I fell apart over I have to say this is the Sessions, and it is a picture about a guy who has polio and who decides he wants to experience sex, even though he can't move anything below his neck. And I have to say, I had forgotten who was in it when I saw it. I saw it way before it opened. And I watched the picture thinking, gosh, that actor is terrific. I wonder if he's actually got polio. Not realizing it was John Hawkes, who I've seen a dozen times.
Sure.
And I was so persuaded by that performance that I can't believe it wasn't nominated. And particularly in this particular year where I thought Marion Cotillard did an amazing job losing her legs. I mean, these are the kinds of parts that the joke is that if you play them, you get an Oscar nomination, right? And neither of them got nominated. And those two were heartbreakers.
Yeah, I mean, the acting nominations, there were definitely some ones that surprised me. I actually thought, getting back to Amour, which, again, we'll talk about some other time, but Jean-Louis Trintignant, who is the non-dying half of the couple in Amour, is, I think, absolutely stunning in that movie. It is the quieter, more contained, less physical performance. Linda, you and I have talked about how Emmanuel Riva, her performance is incredibly physical. You and I have talked about that. His is so contained, and I think incredibly good. And I was disappointed that he wasn't nominated. But who do you then take out?
I hate to say it, but Denzel Washington in Flight. I saw Flight just recently, and look, I don't like to pick on the Denzel Washington movie because heaven knows, you know, the Academy nominates the whitest, least diverse group of actors just year after year, and I hate to be like, I don't care that much for the Denzel Washington performance. But, you know, Flight to me, Denzel Washington is very good in Flight. Is he good in the same way that that performance in Amour is good? I don't think so. Is he good to the same degree that John Hawkes in The Sessions is good? I don't think so. But to be honest, the other performance that I might kick out of that category.
I know what you're going to say, and I agree.
Do you?
Joaquin Phoenix?
Well, yes. The Bob, I'm literally, okay.
The jaw drop.
Yeah, literally, Bob's mouth is hanging open.
It's a good performance, but it is a series of tics that he does. It's his thing.
Yeah. The Master was not Stephen's thing.
It was not my thing.
Yeah.
I felt like it was a whole bunch of acting exercises in pursuit of a movie.
Make the case for Joaquin Phoenix, Bob.
I don't know. I hardly know where to start.
He can't believe there is such a thing as making...
Why do I have to make a case for Joaquin Phoenix? I thought he was astonishing in the picture. I thought he was just sort of breathtaking almost all the time. That sequence where he's answering the questions, where
that's a wonderful
the two
scene.
Of them, is just a it's beautiful piece
that is
of
a
acting.
Wonderful scene.
I thought he was absolutely spectacular and redeemed everything he'd done in the previous 2 years by making this movie. And I actually thought The Master was a gorgeous piece of filmmaking and belonged in the 10 Best Picture nominations.
Yeah, that would have been the 10th.
Because it's beautiful to watch. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I understand what you're saying about the difference between the more... It's not routine. How do you describe what Denzel Washington is doing? Because it's a remarkable piece of acting, but he's doing extreme acting in a way. He's being asked to do things that are not particularly delicate. And
yeah. I don't think it's as complex of a story, for one thing. Mm. I mean, it is a complex story. Flight is not a bad movie. I'm not here to say Flight's a bad movie.
No, he's very good in it.
But it didn't impress me the way that some of these other films did, and particularly the fact that the screenplay of Flight was nominated for Best Original Screenplay over some other ones. Like, even, I would have loved to see the screenplay for something like Looper
be
nominated.
What was I was going to say.
Because it is so innovative and so interesting, and I thought so well written.
I was looking over the list of... my favorite films of the year, and it occurred to me, okay, here's what I've learned. The films I like don't win Oscars. They don't even get nominated for Oscars. Right. They get nominated, if they get nominated for anything, for screenplay. So a movie I liked a lot that did end up getting nominated for screenplay was Moonrise Kingdom.
Right.
I really love that
movie.
It's
a charming movie.
Does it break my heart that it's not nominated for Best Picture? No, because I just don't. I've lowered my expectations.
It's a small picture in a way. You talk about contained worlds.
Yeah.
That's a very contained world. It's a vision we've seen before from that director, Wes Anderson. I would have liked to have seen that nominated for Best Picture.
But seeing Flight on that list and not Looper on the list of original screenplays was just weird to me because that movie is about something. It's one of those films. It's a thinking person's science fiction film in which the science fiction is doing something metaphorically. You're meeting your younger self and you're talking to your younger self. I mean, that's what the film's about in and above the time-traveling stuff. There was another film I really liked that was very, very small called Chronicle. It got released at the beginning of the year. It's about these kids who develop superpowers, but it keeps the focus on them very tight, very smart, very controlled, as Bob would say. Wanderlust. Paul Rudd and Jennifer Aniston being charming. I mean, what's going to be wrong with that? I really love Jiro Dreams of Sushi. Documentary didn't get nominated.
Their documentary nominations are always bad.
I don't understand it. Two of films that I would never put up as Best Picture, but I'm going to say I had a great time last year, was 21 Jump Street. That was a very fun movie.
And snubbed.
Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. I would see Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter 6 times before I see Lincoln again. Cabin in the Woods. Talk about a pretty smart screenplay that should have got some more attention.
That's true.
And Bernie, again, we've talked about Bernie a lot on the show, but that's a great small movie.
Yeah, I just saw Bernie actually over the weekend wanting to test my theory of a movie that had it been championed by Harvey Weinstein would have been nominated for Best Picture.
Because
the politics of that drive me absolutely bananas. I think Bernie's a small enough picture that it might have struggled, but that is a wonderfully realized, small, very small vision of this little Texas town. It just nails little Texas towns. Jack Black is wonderful in it. I am an avowed Jack Black fan.
Yeah.
That was one I would have liked to have seen get some attention. I really like Richard Linklater, too.
Yeah, I mean, look, the list of 9 films, and I said this on Twitter on Thursday when the nominations came out, this list of 9 films is a pretty good list of 9 films. Mm-hmm. There's nothing on here that I don't think is worth seeing for one reason or another. Right. Some of them are fantastic. Some of them are just good, solid filmmaking. But there's nothing on here I didn't enjoy watching. I mean, I haven't seen Life of Pi yet. That's the only one on this list I haven't seen yet.
I like Life of Pi.
But I can't imagine that's going to be the one that I say, you know, I don't want to sit through it again. They're all good movies. And,
well,
and
the public's
like
already
that.
Embraced them, too.
Right.
I mean, the 7 of those 10, by the time you get to the Oscar ceremony, 7 of those 9 pictures are going to have achieved $100 million at the box office.
Yeah.
Well, my kids love their Amour Happy Meal. Those little Happy Meal toys are a big hit with the kids.
I would like to do a shout out to the Weinsteins for what they've accomplished, however, with Silver Linings Playbook, which is a very small picture, which is going to do a lot of business because they're behind it. And the idea that they have managed to, that picture getting 4 acting nominations is astonishing. And I looked it up to see when the last time was that had happened.
Oh, it's like 1961.
No, it's 81.
81.
It's
Reds.
It's Reds, yeah.
Reds, but, right. But the list of pictures that have actually accomplished that are amazing. Bonnie and Clyde, Streetcar Named Desire, Network. My personal fave is Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which only had 4 actors and still got nominated in 4 categories, which is really impressive. Uh-huh. But, I mean, pictures that have done that have sort of stood the test of time for the most part.
Yeah.
And I think this one is kind of a quirky picture for that to be happening too, but I was glad it did.
I like Silver Linings. I love that Bradley Cooper performance. That performance some people really dig and other people really don't. I really like that performance. I'm really glad it was nominated. There was a lot of back and forth about whether it would be or wouldn't be. I was really glad it was.
And I love Jackie Weaver. Oh,
that was
God.
A surprise to me. Yeah, that was a surprise to me, too. But good for her. Yeah. At any rate, if you have snubs you would like to talk about, or if you don't believe in snubs,
I'm going to get yelled at for criticizing the master. Which is a
and you laugh at Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, but it makes a promise in its title that it keeps with the audience.
Anyway, if you have opinions about the Oscars, come and find us on Facebook or at the blog. And tell
us
all
about
it.
The master.
Why don't
it's
you
fine.
Stop? Stop. Anyway, that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, you know, I've been pounding down movies, and the problem is we just talked about all of them.
I know, I have the same problem.
I did see Frankenweenie, trying to get caught up on the animated movies, and it's a cute, fun little movie. I don't know if it's necessarily what's making me happy. So I'm going to go with the fact that I saw a commercial the other day for the new season of American Idol. And
oh, dear.
I realized that I have sort of fully recovered from my Stockholm syndrome with that show, where I used to watch every episode of it. And then I sort of made the decision, largely because of horrible, horrible Steven Tyler and his leering at 15-year-old girls. And I quit watching American Idol. And now there's a new season, and it doesn't have Steven Tyler on it. And I feel no compulsion to watch
it. Yeah, you have no desire to watch
it. I feel entirely cured of American Idol.
That's
and
wonderful.
I realized that it wasn't just this one thing that was keeping me away. And now I have so many of my hours back to presumably try to watch good things.
That's wonderful. I'm very proud of you.
Thank you.
Bob Mondello, is anything making you happy this week?
Maggie Smith.
Oh, of course.
I feel terrible. I'm completely addicted to Downton Abbey.
It must be that chair. I'm sitting in Trey's chair.
Is that what does it? Oh, my God. I just... I adore this woman. Now, I saw her a zillion years ago in a Tom Stoppard play in London called Night and Day. And she was kind of amazing in that. And this is before I knew her as, you know, what did she, the Prime Minister Jean Brodie, all the zillions of things she's done. So I knew her when she was a relatively young woman. And I discovered when I went to the Stratford Festival not too long ago that because they have one of her costumes, that she cannot be 5'3". She's tiny.
Really?
And she's so imposing. Wow. She's terrifying as the Dowager Empress of Downton Abbey. And I just, so anyway, I just, every time she says anything, when she said the other day, oh, I thought you were a waiter. And I just lost
it. They are writing her a lot of good stuff this season. God. A lot of good zingers.
I'm surprised to find out she's short because I saw her in London doing Edward Albee's Three Tall Women and she blew the roof off the dump. I mean, she was great.
Holy cow.
And it's in the title.
It's right there in the title. Well, sometimes clothes do shrink.
Well, actually, on stage, a lot of people who you think are going to be taller are very diminutive. But she is she's really short, and I just didn't know that. And boy, can she command!
Yeah, Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
You know, I always forget if this is Plutarch or Pliny the Elder. It's one of those who said famously, "Come on down to Harmontown, turn that frown upside down." Pee is yellow, poop is brown, come on down to Harmontown. That is the sung-through riff, the sort of Rihanna Dido riff that is sung while on the podcast Harmontown. Dan Harmon, creator of Community and Heat Vision of Jack and other great things, that accompanies his terrible rapping skills with a Z. Terrible. Guy can't rap, but He owns it. And this comedy podcast on paper maybe shouldn't work. This thing is basically Dan Harmon in front of a crowd with his friend Jeff Davis. Harmon is self-obsessed. He self-flagellates, but he is also very, very, very self-aware. And that should not necessarily play, that should make him insufferable. But God, he's funny. He's weirdly charming. He's incredibly truthful and really wise about the business we call show, and not apologetic. He was fired from Community, and he owns it, and he understands why it happened, and he'll tell you why it happened, and he's not fine with it, but he's really funny. He's really funny about it. So it also helps that on this podcast, they take a moment or two and play D&D. They're on the road now. They're touring the country in a bus, actually. So Harmontown is coming to your town. What I love about when they play D&D is that Harmon's sensibilities infiltrates every adventure campaign. So he plays a sensitive magic user with daddy issues, and every so often the campaign kind of devolves into his character trying to emotionally connect with his wrathful barbarian father. So it's not for everybody's tastes. As my mom would say, there's language. Mom's big into semiotics. There's language. Lots of poop jokes, lots of boner jokes, but if this is for you, it's certainly for me. Harmontown, a comedy podcast.
Wonderful. Well, like Stephen, I have spent so much of the last week catching up on movies and or paying attention to award shows and or live blogging various people and or whatever that I really did not have a good opportunity to come up with something that has nothing to do with anything we've talked about before. So I came up with three that are either extensions of things we've already talked about. Well, that's what they are. The first thing that made me happy this week was, once again, the performance of Amy Poehler and Tina Fey in the Golden Globes, simply because I think there has been a long history of not having very many women hosts of award shows. It has happened occasionally. And every time that you send a pair of women out and they're awesome and funny, especially with all this stupid "are women funny" stuff, when they send, I mean, that room was so, as Joe Reed put it, so hot from the beginning.
Not Tommy Lee Jones.
Well, everybody except Tommy Lee Jones. That room was so excited, and I was so happy for them that they were so successful, because it just, to me, that's a great example of good hosting, and I hope that they continue to follow it. Second thing, we've been talking over the last couple of months of this podcast, we've made a couple of mentions of Roseanne and how great it is and how much we respect, especially their Halloween stuff. But I have been, the last couple weekends, I've gotten sucked into Roseanne marathons on Saturdays. And I was watching it this weekend and really being impressed again with how good the family stuff is, and particularly how sharp it was about insecurities in parenting and their fears of not being good parents or not having good relationships with their kids or repeating mistakes that they feel their parents made with them. There was an episode on that is centered on Dan's relationship with Becky.
Yeah.
And it's so charming. And it was the beginning of, if you know, the sort of whole saga of this family. Dan's relationship with Becky over the entire length of the series, this is the father and the older daughter, that was a very complex relationship that had a lot of very serious problems, and that went on for season after season. And so I was just very much admiring it. Third, Glenn mentioned a short story last week.
Yeah.
Tell them what short story it was.
It's Isabel by the great George Saunders.
So, because I'm nothing if not literary and fancy.
Yay.
And dutiful in following.
And dutiful. And because I still owe him reading The Hobbit, which
yes,
I haven't done.
Yes, you do.
I read this story. And it was really good.
Wasn't it?
And totally awesome. And I totally got it. And I felt like not only did I read a great story, but it brought us closer together.
Sure. So, didn't have any singing dwarves. I think that helped.
That's true.
But yeah, it's sincerely moving. It's, again, generous. It's a very generous story. It's
and, you know, I think they've just recently put that book out in an e-book version, because there's an introduction by Joshua Ferris.
Right.
So this is clearly...
The actual book of stories is called Civil War Land and Bad Decline, which is also a great story. Very funny. But yeah, I'm so glad you liked it.
I read it. I loved it. Great. And I'm going to read some more. Reading all over the place.
Well, you're right.
I'm reading all over the place. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Glenn at GHWeldon, WELDON. He's not here today, but you can follow Trey Graham at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham exactly like the cracker. You can follow our producer, Jess Gittner, at Jess Gittner, G-I-T-N-E-R. And you can follow our esteemed producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are listening to right now. Thanks to all of you, especially Bob.
Yes, thanks, Bob.
Who is not on Twitter. He just leaves messages in bottles.
It's true.
Thanks to all of you guys for being here. And thanks to all of you for listening. And we will see you back here next week.